Chapter 28. They found Chelmsford's last camp on the following afternoon. The neat lines of black camp fires and the flattened areas where the tents had stood, the stakes which had held the horse pickets, and the piles of empty bully beef tins and 5-pound biscuit tins. "They left 2 days ago," said M. Bijeni. Sean nodded, not doubting the correctness of this. "Which way did they go?" "Back towards the main camp at Isandlwana." Sean looked puzzled. "I wonder why they did that." M. Bijeni shrugged. "They went in haste. The horsemen galloped ahead of the infantry." "We'll follow them," said Sean. The spoor was a wide road, for 1,000 men had passed along it, and the wagons and gun carriages had left deep ruts. They slept hungry and cold beside the spoor, and the next morning there was frost in the low places when they started out. A little before noon they saw the granite dome of Isandlwana standing out against the sky, and unconsciously they quickened their pace. Isandlwana, the hill of the little hand. Sean was limping, for his boot had rubbed the skin from one heel. His hair was thick and matted with sweat, and his face was plastered with dust. "Even army bully beef is going to taste good," said Sean in English, and Bijeni did not answer, for he did not understand, but he was looking ahead with a vaguely worried frown on his face. "Nkosi, we have seen no one for 2 days' march. It comes to me that we should have met patrols from the camp before now." "We might have missed them," said Sean without interest. But M. Bijeni shook his head. In silence they went on. The hill was closer now, so they could make out the detail of ledge and fissure that covered the dome in a lacework pattern. "No smoke from the camp," said M. Bijeni. He lifted his eyes and started visibly. "What is it?" Sean felt the first tingle of alarm. "Nyoni," said M. Bijeni softly, and Sean saw them. A dark pall, turning like a wheel slowly high above the hill of Isandlwana. Still so far off they could not distinguish the individual birds, only a shadow, a thin dark shadow in the sky. Watching it, Sean was suddenly cold in the hot noonday sun. He started to run. There was a movement below them on the plain. The torn canvas of an overturned wagon flapped like a wounded bird. The scurry and scuffle of the jackals, and higher up the slope of the kopje, the hunch-shouldered trot of a hyena. "Oh, my God," whispered Sean. M. Bijeni leaned on his spear. His face was calm and withdrawn, but his eyes moved slowly over the field. "Are they dead? Are they all dead?" The question required no answer. He could see the dead men in the grass, thick about the wagons, and then scattered more thinly back up the slope. They looked very small and inconsequential. M. Bijeni stood quietly waiting. A big black colpus vulture planed across their front. The feathers in its wingtips flated like the fingers of a spread hand. Its legs dropped, touched, and it hopped heavily to rest among the dead, a swift transformation from beautiful flight to obscene crouching repose. It bobbed its head, ruffled its feathers, and waded to dip its beak over a corpse that wore the green hunting tartan of the Gordons. "Where's Chelmsford? Was he caught here also?" M. Bijeni shook his head. "He came too late. Emberjani pointed with his spear at the wide spur that skirted the battlefield and crossed the shoulder of his Sandalwana towards the Tugela. "He has gone back to the river. He has not stopped even to bury his dead." Sean and Emberjani walked down towards the field. On the outskirts, they picked their way through the debris of Zulu weapons and shields. There was rust forming on the blades of the assegais. The grass was flattened and stained where the dead had lain, but the Zulu dead were gone, sure sign of victory. They came to the English lines. Sean gagged when he saw what had been done to them. They lay piled upon each other, faces already black, and each one of them had been disemboweled. The flies crawled in their empty stomach cavities. "Why do they do that?" he asked. "Why do they have to hack them up like that?" He walked on heavily past the wagons. Cases of food and drink had been smashed open and scattered in the grass. Clothing and paper and cartridge cases lay strewn around the dead, but the rifles were gone. The smell of putrefaction was so thick that it coated his throat and tongue like castor oil. "I must find Paw." Sean spoke quietly in almost a conversational tone. Emberjani walked a dozen paces behind him. They came to the lines where the volunteers had camped. The tents had been slashed to tatters and trampled into the dust. The horses had been stabbed while still tethered to their picket lines. They were massively bloated. Sean recognized Gypsy, his father's mare. He crossed to her. "Hello, girl," he said. The birds had taken her eyes out. She lay on her side, her stomach so swollen that it was as high as Sean's waist. He walked around her. The first of the Ladyburg men lay just beyond. He recognized all 15 of them, although the birds had been at them also. They lay in a rough circle, facing outwards. Then he found a sparse trail of corpses leading up towards the shoulder of the mountain. He followed the attempt that the volunteers had made to fight their way back towards the Tugela, and it was like following a paper chase. Along the trail, thick on each side of it, were the marks where the Zulus had fallen. "At least 20 of them for every one of us," whispered Sean, with a tiny flicker of pride. He climbed on up, and at the top of the shoulder, close under the sheer rock cliff of his Sandalwana, he found his father. There were 4 of them, the last 4. Waite Courtney, Tim Hope Brown, Hans and Niall Erasmus. They lay close together. Waite was on his back, with his arms spread open. The birds had taken his face away down to the bone, but they had left his beard, and it stirred gently on his chest as the wind touched it. The flies, big metallic green flies, crawled thick as swarming bees in the open pit of his belly. Sean sat down beside his father. He picked up a discarded felt hat that lay beside him and covered his terribly mutilated face. There was a green and yellow silk cockade on the hat, strangely gay in the presence of so much death. The flies buzzed sullenly, and some came to settle on Sean's face and lips. He brushed them away. "You know this man?" asked Emberjani. "My father," said Sean without looking up. "You too." Compassion and understanding in his voice, Emberjani turned away and left them alone. "I have nothing," Emberjani had said. Now Sean also had nothing. There was hollowness. No anger, no sorrow, no ache, no reality even. Staring down at this broken thing, Sean could not make himself believe that this was a man. Meat only, the man had gone. Later, Ember Janey came back. He had cut a sheet of canvas from one of the unburnt wagons, and they wrapped weight in it. They dug his grave. It was hard work, for the soil was thick with rock and shale. They laid weight in the grave with his arms still widespread in rigor mortis, beneath the canvas, for Sean could not bring himself to break them. They covered him gently and piled rocks upon the place. They stood together at the head of the grave. "Well, Pa?" Sean's voice sounded unnatural. He could not make himself believe he was talking to his father. "Well, Pa," he started again, mumbling self-consciously, "I'd like to say thanks for everything you've done for me." He stopped and cleared his throat. "I reckon you know I'll look after Ma and the farm as best I can, and Gary also." His voice trailed away once more, and he turned to Ember Janey. "There's nothing to say." Sean's voice was surprised, hurt almost. "No," agreed Ember Janey. "There is nothing to say." For a few minutes longer, Sean stood struggling to grapple with the enormity of death, trying to grasp the utter finality of it. Then he turned away and started walking towards the Tugela. Ember Janey walked a little to one side and a pace behind him. "It will be dark before we reach the river," thought Sean. He was very tired, and he limped from his blistered heel.